Okay, let's get started, please. So, I'm not sure where everybody is. So, the numbers seem to be particularly down. Is there some? Is something to you right now? No. Okay. Anyway, yeah. Definitely many fewer than last time. So, the topic for today is twofold. One is to look at this issue of exceptions. What, how does a processor handle exceptional situations, and what are these? And then, two, we'll be looking at processor management. So, how we manage the processor, how we control who gets to run programs when, and how we kind of make sure that programs, if they go out of control, don't kind of hog resources, and then. Lock out anybody else from using the processor. Okay, we've got to come on. Sorry, this is just locked up on me. What do we want to do? All right, so on to for the first of these topics, exceptions. So as it says at the top there, exceptional events, exceptions are exceptional events that interrupt the normal program flow require attention of the CPU. And then low down the slide, we see two the kind of two main categories that we deal with of exceptions. First of all, what we call external exceptions, sometimes interrupts. So these aren't caused by the program itself executing, but caused by external events happening. One example is an I/O interrupt. So, for example, you could be you could have had a program which has made a request to read some data from a disk. That often can take several milliseconds, and so your program may then go off and do something else. And then, when the disk is ready, it might want to interrupt whatever's going on to say, hey, look, I've got some data ready now. Do you want to do something with it? Or, for example, commonly in computers today, whenever a given program is running, it's actually only allowed to run for a given slice of time. And then after that, at the end of that time, it's interrupted. And if there's something else that's ready and wanting to run, that is given a chance to get some cycles on the CPU. So you don't get this, and the reason for doing this is to avoid the CPU being hogged just by a single process. Those are examples of external events that cause interrupts. Then we also have internal events, sometimes called traps, which are caused by the program execution itself. So for example, not all opcodes are legal opcodes. There's some operation codes in, the MIPS instruction set, which are reserved for future use. And you might have inadvertently asked the CPU to execute one of these instructions. And in a situation like that, you want the CPU to alert the programmer somehow. And we also, in these situations, invoke the exception mechanism inside the CPU. Also, too, the other example I got up here is arithmetic overflow. You may want to set things up so that if you're doing a divide by zero, or you're adding and multiplying numbers and you get an overflow, you might want to have that situation detected, and you might want some alternative action to be taken on that happening. So to handle exceptions, we have a exception mechanism built into virtually all modern CPUs. And the story I'll be giving you is the story for MIPS. I'll say occasionally how it differs in for other CPUs. But MIPS is certainly representative of what happens. So in MIPS, what happens is the first thing it does, so having an exception coming along is a little bit like a function call, except that the function call is not being caused by a function calling a program, it's caused by the external event coming in. So the first thing we do is we want to save where we've got to in terms of executing the current program. And so inside the CPU, we have a special register called the Exception Program Counter, or EPC. And the first thing we do is we save the current program counter in that register so that once we've finished handling the exception, dealing with it somehow, we can then take the value from the exception program counter register, put it back in the program counter, and continue executing on from where we left off when the exception happened. Next thing we do with the MIPS architecture is there's a single address then that the CPU goes to then start executing special instructions for handling the interrupt. What happens when you're handling interrupt? Well, you want to both deal with whatever caused the exception, so take the appropriate action. If it's a disk that said I've got some data ready, you're going to want to start, say, fetching that data in. If it's a divide by zero, then maybe there's something else that you're going to want to do. One thing also that happens within the interrupt handling is that you want to ensure that at the end of handling the exception, that you can continue executing the program as normal. So this means just as with a function call, what you want to do is certainly save the internal state of the CPU, save the contents of all its registers, so that at the end you can restore those values and your program was never aware that it was interrupted in the first place, if the cause was an external event. And so kind of having done the body of work, what's going to happen is we're going to then go back to program. Well, if the desire is that we go back to the normal program, then that's what we're going to want to do. So we're going to restore the values to the registers that were there at the beginning of handling the interrupt, and then we're going to jump back. And there's a special, in the MIPS instruction set, there's a special instruction called ERET, which allows you to do this, allows you to pull the value from this exception program counter register back into the program counter. And so we use this rather than, say, the as a jump register instruction too that you could imagine using, but that only works with the general purpose registers. And so we have a special instruction here to pull the value from this exception program counter register. There are other reasons too why we use ERET, and we'll come to those shortly. Of course, as I was hinting, sometimes you may not want to go back to the user program if the exception was caused by a divide by zero, and the decision is on something like a divide by zero, the program should actually halt or transfer control to a debugger. Then you might want the interrupt handler itself to play around with, say, the value in the exception program counter register, so that when the ERET instruction is executed, control is actually transferred to some alternative destination. So that's a kind of high-level picture of what happens when we handle an interrupt. So let's look in a tiny bit more detail at what happens in that the middle phase, so what happens in this step three here. So how do we know who caused the exception if there's a single place that we jump to? There are different ways of doing this. In MIPS, what happens is that there's another special register inside the CPU called the cause register. And depending on what's caused the interrupt, a different value will be written to that register. With MIPS, for example, so you can have these external causes interrupts. I think, if I remember right, with MIPS, it allows for there to be 5 or 6 possible different sources of external interrupts. And for each one of those, there'll be a separate code written to this cause register. And then, too, for things like divide by zeros or arithmetic overflows, there will be different values, again, written to this cause register. An alternative approach that happens with other CPU architectures, not MIPS, is that you actually have not just a single address that interrupt handling starts from, but you have multiple addresses. And each, say, if you've got 10 kinds of interrupts, you might have 10 different addresses that exception handling might start from, depending on which one comes along. Another very important thing that you need to do when you're handling an interrupt is make sure that you're not going to be interrupted yet again. So you can imagine right at the start of handling an interrupt, you're doing things like you're saving registers. If you don't do that properly and you get interrupted again, you can get into a rather inconsistent, unexpected state. So it's quite important that interrupts be prevented right at the start of handling a given interrupt. Sometimes for the whole of handling an interrupt, you want to mask all other interrupts. Sometimes handling an interrupt itself can be quite a long process. So what you do would be to, at the beginning, disable all other interrupts. When you're in the middle phase of handling an interrupt, you then allow other interrupts to come along. And perhaps at the end, you would disable them again while you're doing some critical work. And to do this, there's a special bit that you can to disable other interrupts or mask them, as we say. There's a special bit that gets set or reset in another register called the status register. In MIPS, this bit goes by the title of the exception level bit. And when an exception is first handled, this bit is set, and that prevents then other interrupts from actually having an effect from immediately being handled. We can also have software exceptions where we kind of use the exception mechanism from actual user programs. And you've actually seen this in writing your MIPS code. When you do one of these sys calls, you're essentially in software invoking the interrupt handling mechanism. This doesn't just happen in this artificial SPIM example, but it's It happens to be the main way in which a user program interacts with the operating system. It uses these syscall instructions, which start up the exception handling mechanism, but then put a special value in the calls register saying this exception is from a syscall. So that's noted there. And as I say, otherwise the same mechanism is invoked as is used for handling these other hardware interrupts. And then as you did in the MIPS assignment, you then pass parameters to the syscall function, like you say, what function you want to call and what values you want to call it with, by putting special values into certain registers. So why do we do this? Why do we not use a jump and link instruction, for example, which is the standard way of calling a function? Why don't we use a jump and link instruction to call operating system functions? Why do we have this special? Why do we go through the exception mechanism instead? Well, so this slide tries to explain it, and it has to do with kind of two modes which we allow the processor to work in. One of these modes we call the user mode. This is the mode that your program normally executes in. And the other one's called the kernel mode, sometimes the system mode, which is a more privileged mode where the CPU is allowed to do more things. And whenever you whenever you have an exception happening, whether it's from an external cause or some internal cause or a syscall, what usually happens is the mode bit, which determines whether the CPU is working in kernel mode or user mode, that mode bit switches from user to kernel. So then when the exception is being handled, it's got full access to certain privileged resources, which a normal user program doesn't get access to. So for example, let's give some examples here. So privileged instructions only are executed in a kernel mode. So for example, instructions for actually accessing a disk or instructions for handling memory. So we'll talk about it next week. But when your program is executing, it's not allowed to, at random, choose any arbitrary address in memory and read or write data there. Every program, when it's running, has a very restricted subset of the memory addresses that it can actually access. And when you go from user mode to kernel mode, then you can start in kernel mode. You're actually allowed to play around with controlling who's got access to what data. But when you're back in user mode, you only have access to, you're not able to open up some memory for access. The functionality available to you is much more restricted. So, saying at the top here that this kernel mode can only be, there's this kernel mode bit, which determines whether you're in user mode or kernel mode. We said that it's set when you call an exception, when an exception happens. And that happens to be the only way in which you can enter kernel mode from user mode. So there's no other way of doing it. You can't use one of these jump and link instructions, for example, to jump directly to codes in the operating system. And so we have this e-return instruction for what happens at the very end of executing some exception handler. And one extra function that this e-ret instruction takes on also is to switch the mode back from kernel mode to user mode. So I don't know if, so for the story I've told you so far, I'm just going to one brief remark about that last point in that last slide. I was saying that when you're executing an exception, you can get interrupted again. So in such a, if you're in such a very special, more special situation, of course, you want to be a bit more careful about what happens when you return from your kind of inner second exception, because you're returning back to another exception handler. And in that particular case, you wouldn't want to return back to user mode. So there's special ways of handling that situation. On this slide, what I'm talking about is, or what's been talked about, is kind of talking, it's exploring a bit more about why we have these two modes and what it's achieving. So it's all in the name of security and stability. So security meaning that one process executing can't access randomly the memory space or resources which are being used by other processes. There's restrictions on what each process is allowed to do. And stability too is the whole issue of ensuring that if one process has some rogue behavior some way, that somehow its behavior is confined, that it's not going to bring down the whole system. So kind of when we want this, to provide these guarantees, we use a combination of properties ensured by the hardware, that's handling exceptions, and also parts of the operating system code itself. So for example, I've got the first point here is that the hardware guarantees that control is transferred to the operating system when a program, when programs attempt to perform potentially dangerous tasks. So for example, when a program tries to access some memory it shouldn't access, or it tries to execute some special privileged instruction that should only be executed in kernel mode. So we need hardware to help us with that. And also too, we have a hardware to help ensure that user programs do not have indefinite control of the processor. And so we'll come to this a bit later, but the basic idea here is that whenever a process starts running, there's a timer which is started. And when that timer reaches a timeout value, then the process that's running is automatic, a interrupt signal is generated by the timer hardware, which then interrupts the execution of the current process and allows the operating system to decide should that process be allowed to continue to execute further, or should somebody else be allowed to have a chance of executing on the CPU. So this is a kind of standard feature in current architectures and operating systems. But say if you look way back at early versions of Windows, it didn't have this timeout mechanism, and that made this whole system extremely fragile and extremely prone to locking up. As a user program could go into an infinite loop, for example, and the whole system would just freeze, and you just had to hit the power button. You really didn't have any other alternative. And it's obviously not very desirable. So we also, there's this kind of partnership between the hardware and the operating system to ensure security and stability. So on the operating side, the operating system also takes on the job of helping to manage that programs don't interfere with each other, that each program, say, gets access to a logically separate piece of memory, and that if, say, the memory of two processes overlaps, it only overlaps when those two processes, in some sense, have agreed to that overlap. And two, there's kind of issues about access to, not just accesses to kind of memory, but accesses to other resources like files that on all, virtually all operating systems, every file has associated with it some access permissions saying who can access this given file. And that is enforced by the operating system. So if a given user program's coming along and it wants to, say, open a file for reading, it's the operating system then which actually checks, does that user program have permission to open that file? And if not, I'm not going to allow that. So now, in the lecture, I'm going to shift more to kind of talking about the tasks that the operating system takes on, some of the most basic tasks. I'm going to be looking at the issue of how a CPU handles executing many processes simultaneously. So I'm assuming everybody's kind of heard this term process before. The basic concept of process is given at the bottom here. You just think of a process as a program in execution. So kind of historically, the idea of allowing many programs to run at once, this idea was it was kind of thought about and programmed because I/O operations took a long time compared to the time it took to execute instructions. These days, the comparison is particularly extreme. If you're reading and writing a disk, kind of the time taken from asking for access to a disk to data actually flowing can be the order of 10 or 20 or 30 milliseconds. Whereas your CPU is executing an instruction every nanosecond or every 500 picoseconds or something. So you've got a kind of factor of well over a million or 10 million in terms of the rates of two things happening. And if you just had a process kind of waiting around for the disk to be ready, you'd lose the opportunity to execute 10 million instructions. So that was, when you're kind of doing IOs, that's a particularly, or you're in a situation where you've got a lot of, or even just some, input-output traffic to a disk, you really, really, really want to be ensuring that the processor can do something else while it's waiting, while some process is waiting for input or output. And I've already referred to a couple of times also this other motivation too of making sure that if one program or process crashing or one process monopolizing the CPU, you want to make sure that if that happens, that the whole system isn't brought down, that particular rogue process is contained somehow. Either its crash is detected and handled, or at least it's quarantined. It's things are set up so that it doesn't affect the performance too much of everything else that's trying to execute. So I'm building towards this here, the kind of basic idea is we allow the CPU over time to switch between different processes. And for example, the switch can happen when you make a request for some I/O transfer, or perhaps you have this time slice timer timing out and saying, hey, you've had enough time, or saying to one process, hey, you've had enough time, and then allowing the operating system to decide, well, there's this other process waiting, let's let that other process get in there and have a go at getting some CPU time in. So here's on the next slide. Here's a kind of picture of multitasking going on. So here's our a single process coming along. An I/O request is made here. We've got maybe our 10 or 20 milliseconds of wait here, and then we start running again. And then we've got all this time here, which we're just wasting. In a multitasking system, at this point, we make a system call. We use one of these syscalls for I/O. There's a bit of time involved, this red zone here, in setting things up for the I/O transfer, notifying the disk controller that we want to do a data transfer. But then the operating system might know that there's some other process which is waiting to execute, and it might then let that second process run. Then when the I/O disk comes along and says, hey, I'm ready to, I've got some data for you in a buffer ready for you to copy over, maybe the disk interrupts the CPU and an interrupt handler runs again here. And then after that interrupt handler is finished, maybe the right thing to do is let process one get back in again and handle that data that's just been read from the CPU. So is this all making kind of rough sense on a kind of, I'm being a bit vague right now, but I'm trying to get over the general idea of multitasking. Is this making sense? Good. All right, so we have this notion of a process. So a process is a program in execution, and we have inside the operating system for each and every process, there's a little state machine which says what state that process is in. And this is a kind of the simplest version of that state machine. We have three states that a process can be in. We've got a ready state here. Sorry, the running state is, let's start with this one. Running state is when our process is running, so its instructions are being executed on the CPU. However, for example, we might have an I/O request. There might be a syscall from our program for some I/O. In that case, it goes into what's called a blocked state. So the idea of being blocked is that our process can't go on any further. It's blocked from continuing execution by something. In this case, it's, say, blocked by needing to wait for some data coming from a disk, for example. We then have a third state called the ready state, and we might go from a blocked state to the ready state when the disk controller says back to the operating system, hey, I've got some data ready for this process that requested it. The ready state for a process, or when a process is in a ready state, it's not actually running, but it's ready to run. What we're saying is there's nothing holding up this process from running. If the operating system decides this process wants to execute, you can give it time on the CPU. And so the operating system then has a dispatcher, which then periodically takes a look at all the ready processes and decides which of those ready processes is going to get a go next on actually running on the CPU. And then we've got one final transition here from running to ready on timeouts. So this is when our process has been running for, say, some preset period, and this in the background, this hardware timer has been ticking along and has reached its timeout value and has generated an interrupt. On that interrupt generation, then, the running process's state would make this transition from a running state to a ready state, and then the operating system would then decide, well, okay, you've had your time, maybe somebody else is ready and waiting to go, or conversely, it may be, so sometimes what happens is every process has a priority, and the operating system lets higher priority processes run instead of lower priority processes. So it might be that the timeout has interrupted the current highest priority process, and in the pool of ready processes, there's no other process of higher priority. So actually, it could be the same process after momentarily going into the ready state actually is allowed to go back and run again. On the other hand, it may be that there's some other process of equal priority ready there, and in that case, one of those other ones will be allowed to run. So the next slide also kind of goes through what I talked through in words and introduces a couple of extra details. So at the top here, process calls the OS, interrupt is requested. There should be an OR in there. So we could have a syscall. So what we imagine here is we've got a process in a running state, and perhaps there's a syscall, or perhaps the time slice timer generates an interrupt. in that situation, the components of the operating system called the dispatcher carries out what we call a context switch. So I guess we assume here in general that that maybe some other process is going to be allowed to run. So what we're switching is the kind of current context in which the CPU is executing, the current process that the CPU is handling. So what we have when we stop a process, when we take a process from a running state to the ready state, for example, or to the block state, what we do is we save information about that process that will allow us to resume it later. So for example, we save all the contents of the registers in the program counter. And a special part of memory associated with the process called the process control block. So each and every process has one of these process control blocks. Down here, listed some of the contents that you find in there. So we find the state of the state machine that we saw before, that could be in a block that could indicate whether the process is blocked or running or whatever. Typically, too, every process has a unique identifier. Often we call this just a PID, process identifier. We talked a bit about priorities of processes. So for each process, this process control block might record its priority. And permissions as well. So you might be familiar with, in many systems, there's a notion of having root permission. So root, if you've got root permission, you're the most privileged user who has many more rights to access data and files and so on than the normal user, who's much more restricted. So information about the privileges of a given process could be kept in its process control block as well. So this dispatcher program is kind of one of the programs which is managing the transitions in that state machine that you saw on the previous slide, and making decisions like which new process should be run, and then as needed, it updates the states of different processes. So when a computer is running, typically the number and type and kind of the processes there is not just static and set up once and for all, but over the lifetime of a computer running, new processes get created, or processes kind of reach the end of their life and die or are killed off. We've got often we have a tree-like arrangement of processes where, and when we have that, we talk about processes having being a parent process or a child process. And the basic idea with these trees The basic idea in a tree is that the hierarchy of the tree keeps track of who's created different processes. So generally, whenever a process is created, it's created from another process. And the idea is you have some initial process, which then, over time, creates more processes. Then these new processes become the child processes of this original process. So we say this process then is the parent process, say, of this process here. This one here is the child of this process up here. So using standard terminology that we associate with the tree data structures that we draw in this fashion. I assume by now you've seen trees in Antoine, yes? Yeah, good. This kind of had the setting up of these associations between parent and child processes, also something that the dispatcher does. And for example, when it creates a new child process, then one thing it records is who is the parent of this new process. If you're running on dice, if I'm right, I think you could do something like echo dollar PPID as a terminal prompt, and that will tell you, for example, the process identifier for the parent process of the process you're running in. All right, so with an operating system, we usually try to distinguish a subset of programs which are more critical than other ones. So for example, all the code that's executed when exceptions happen, we label as being more critical components of the operating system. So collectively, we call this more critical, this collection of more critical components, the kernel of the operating system. And generally, we desire this to be small, so that it's easier to ensure that it's correct. The larger codes gets, the more likely it's got bugs, and then the harder it is to find bugs. Also, too, because the kernel is used very frequently, its performance is usually quite critical. So we want to be really careful that it's designed well. Some of the tasks that happen within the kernel of the operating system include the following. So interrupt handling, process creation and destruction. This dispatcher code are helping us switch processes. Memory management, so this is the issue of allowing each, or saying what memory addresses each process can access. And we'll talk more about that next week, but that's another function that the kernel takes on. And then inter-process communication and synchronization. For example, two processes might want to communicate with each other through what's called a socket, a kind of an agreed upon operating system resource. And so one process might listen on that socket, another one might write to that socket. Or there's these things called pipes that can be set up. Or maybe there's a shared area of memory that could be set up where two processes are allowed to read and write and share data. It's also synchronization between processes. Two processes might need to collaborate on some task, and then one might, at a given time, have to wait for some signal from some other process saying, okay, you can continue now because I've got sufficiently far in what I've needed to do. And another thing is I/O support, so say interfacing to a hard-weighted disk, or maybe talking to some Ethernet controller that's allowing us to talk over a network. So I want to say a little bit more about this process diagram. There's this this diagram, is this issue of what states can a process be in. So sometimes it can be the case that there's not enough physical memory on your computer to allow some of that memory to be allocated to every single process that might be live at a given instance. And so the question is, what do we do then? That sometimes then what we want to do is we want the, we're going to have a notion of some processes being higher priority than other ones, and perhaps when those higher priority ones have to run, we allow them to use much of the physical memory, and maybe some of the lower priority processes have to have all their the data that they've got in memory transferred over to a disk and held on a disk. This arrangement goes by name of swapping. We talk about processes being swapped in and out between memory and disk. So what this means, so when a process is swapped out from memory to disk, we mean that all the electronic physical memory that's been used to store the program or store the data all that information is transferred to a special space on the disk called the swap space. And then that physical memory is freed up for the use of other processes. When a process is swapped in, it's fetched back from disk into memory. You probably had experience of swapping in and out, maybe not fully realizing what was going on. If you come along to your computer, and especially if it's been sleeping for a while, or maybe just you've got many programs running simultaneously, and you go to one which hasn't been active for a while, you might find that it takes a while for that program that you're just switching to start up. And while it's starting up, you might hear the disk drive head clicking away, and you might see the disk drive light flashing away quite a bit. So what's happening there is the process or the application you're trying to access has been swapped out onto disk. And then when you're getting it to wake up, the operating system is swapping, bringing in all the data that's on the disk into the physical memory again, both the kind of the working data and the programs and the program data itself. So that's kind of what this example of swapping. To kind of model processes getting swapped in and swapped out, what we'll do, I'll show you in the next slide, is we can add a couple of extra states to our three-state diagram. However, typically what we do is we still, the process control block of a process is much, much more compact than the actual kind of memory occupied by a process itself. So it's okay to maintain within physical memory all the time a process control block for every process. So let's see. So here we've got our previous diagram, and what we've done is just to add a couple of extra states, which we call inactive states. We call these other states up here the active states. So from, say, both a ready state or the block state, we allow a process to be suspended. So we allow the operating system to decide this process is lower priority and other processes of higher priority needing access to memory. I want at this stage to swap some process with, say, this state table out. And then we take this suspended transition here, or if we're in a block state, we take the suspend transition here. Then when, say, like in that example I gave you, so you kind of wave the mouse or you wake call or you ask for some application to be woken up, then inactive process might be brought back to being active again. So it might be, say, it might have been originally in a ready state, in which case it might be taken to a suspended ready state, or maybe it was in a block state and then taken to a suspended block state. And then perhaps even while the process is swapped out, we allow for it to stay inactive, but for there to be some notification, at least some operation that the process was blocking on has been completed. So we allow, while a process is in the inactive state, for this transition here to be taken. And then perhaps some later stage, it's brought back in again and put into the ready state. All right, so that's kind of the end of the material I wanted to cover today. In terms of kind of reference material for this, as I hope all of you have seen by now, accompanying, we have these slides online. We have accompanying the slides, we have some notes which give the material from the slides in a bit more detail. For this particular lecture, you can find some of the material on exceptions in the Patterson and Hennessy book. There's also a second book on operating systems. Now, this other book on operating systems, it's referenced on the schedule page. It's very much there for background reference. I would say it's really not worth your while for this course going out and buying this book. But it's in the library. Most editions at the level we're concerned with here are completely okay. that there's way more information in that book than you need for this course. But if you want to just read up a bit more about operating systems, then I encourage you to go out and have a look at, just have a browse through that book and have a look at the sections that I point you to on the schedule page for the course. All right, that's it for today. One just announcement, this Friday there is, yes, we have a, normally have a lecture Friday. This Friday there will be no lecture, and the next lecture is going to be on Tuesday next week. So I'll see you all Tuesday next week. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll see you next time.